This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. As we near the 20-year anniversary of 9/11, many Americans are reflecting on the attacks and their fallout. For some, that fallout included a rise in Islamophobia.
I'm Black, but I'm brown passing. And I noticed that I would experience an intense amount of harassment. It would even end up being followed by people in stores and different locations.
It was a time full of anxiety and stress and fear for my family members, especially my female family members who wore the traditional hijab.
People would say these horrible things to me. And what I stopped doing was I stopped straightening my hair so I wouldn't have to experience this harassment.
You know, our male friends and relatives who wore beards, you know, many of them shaved their beards and stopped wearing Islamic garb.
It was weird existing in a world where I, for once, had the ability to stop passing as something, to experience harassment from a whole different perspective than the type of harassment I was normally used to.
It was a time of great anxiety and fear, one which forced my family and I really to detach ourselves in many ways from mainstream America and really just stick to our own kind for fear that people outside of our group would not be so welcoming.
Hate crimes against Muslims in America spiked 500% between 2000 and 2009. That's according to data from Brown University. And surveillance programs led to the detention of thousands, including the Bush administration's registry of non-U.S. citizens from Muslim-majority countries. How have we emerged from that moment? And given the fact that hate crimes in the U.S. just hit a 12-year high, what have we learned? Joining us now to reflect on the anti-Muslim discrimination following 9/11 is Rosina Ali. She's a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. Rosina, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Professor Deepa Kumar. She's a professor of media studies at Rutgers University and the author of Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire, 20 Years After 9/11. Deepa, welcome.
Thank you.
And also with us is Asad Dandia, a New York-based educator and organizer. Asad, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I would love to hear from each of you what you remember about the aftermath of September 11th as a Muslim person in America. Rosina, I'll come to you first.
Yeah. Well, I was in California at the time, and I was with my parents. My parents were watching the attacks on TV. And I distinctly remember my father saying, please don't let it be a Muslim, please don't let it be a Muslim. And that's because there had been terrorist attacks in the U.S., abroad, and because in popular culture, Muslims were depicted and Arabs were depicted as terrorists. So there was that fear that it might be a Muslim. But the other fear that he was talking about was what the government might do. And I was not, I didn't quite understand what he meant until I observed it myself years later, how the government responded. But, you know, one thing I should also point out is that we were immigrants. We were not citizens at the time. And I think immigrants in particular had a different experience than Muslim citizens as well.
Deepa, what about for you?
So I want to clarify that I am not Muslim. I am, as one of the people you played at the beginning of the program, Muslim looking. And so I was in North Carolina at the time that 9/11 happened. And the day of the attacks, of course, all of us were shocked and horrified as to what had happened. We were all afraid that maybe some of our friends or relatives might be on the Twin Towers. But I went to school. I was teaching at Wake Forest University at that point, and I went to school to teach my classes. And one of the first things that I encountered was a colleague who jeered at me and said, "Are you happy?" And I was just so shocked to, you know, encounter this. Why would I be happy, I wondered. And then on the way back home, I went to a grocery store to pick up groceries, and the checkout counter clerk was just so angry. And finally, he just came out and said, "You need to apologize for what your people did." And again, I was just so stunned at how an entire group of people, not just those who practice Islam, but everyone who quote unquote looks Muslim, was collectively held responsible for the actions of 19 people.
Asad, and your experience after 9/11?
I was actually in New York on 9/11. So I spent my entire life in Gotham, born and raised here. I had just returned from a trip, a family trip to Pakistan. My family is of Pakistani background. And I was actually in the hospital. I was sick. I had gotten sick from the trip and I was hospitalized. And you were able to actually see the smoke from the towers from my hospital windows. And I vividly remember my mother, who was tending to me, getting into an argument with one of the nurses that was assigned to my room. And it was a very, I don't remember the precise contours or the details, but I do remember it had something to do with 9/11. And it became a very vicious argument. And to me, it was very jarring because this is someone who was entrusted to take care of me, and how quickly the environment just shifted to one of animosity towards me and my people. And it really drove home for me, you know, what happens, you know, in circumstances like this, where someone who quite literally who is entrusted to take care of you can in an instant view you as enemy or as suspect. And I spent, you know, much of my years in New York growing up in a very defensive posture because of circumstances and instances like that one.
Asad, how did daily life change for you following 9/11?
So I actually was one of the individuals who was spied on directly as a result of the NYPD's policies. When I started undergrad, my friends and I co-founded a charity. And that charity, you know, to put it in simple terms, was doing what today we call mutual aid. Basically, a bunch of us pooling together whatever allowances or money we were getting from our internships to buy groceries to deliver them to working class, poor and working class families in our local neighborhoods whom we knew needed help. It had later turned out that one of the volunteers who had participated with my organization turned out to be an informant, which sent our community into a spiral and eventually led to me participating in a lawsuit against police surveillance.
We'll be back with more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. This message comes from Capital One. With the Capital One Venture Card, you earn unlimited double miles on every purchase every day. And you can use those miles toward travel expenses like flights, hotels, rental cars, and more. Just book and pay for your travel using your Venture Card and redeem your miles toward the cost. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USANA.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're discussing post-9/11 Islamophobia. Let's get back to the conversation. Asad, we were talking about the lawsuit you joined against the New York City Police Department, but you discovered you were being tracked. It started with a Facebook message you got. What happened?
So long story short, I used to get, you know, messages quite often from young people wanting to participate in the work that we were doing. And this young man messaged me in March of 2012, saying that he wanted to be part of a spiritually grounded community that's doing service work. And of course, I welcomed him in. We were a volunteer-based organization. About a month later, in April of 2012, someone from my neighborhood, a local person from my community, who happened to be a police officer, took me to the side one night to inform me that he saw my name on a file in his police precinct. And literally my photos and my name were on a file in a in his local police precinct, and he had informed me that you're being watched. And of course I was shaken by that revelation. He of course was not allowed to tell me this. And many months later in October, as I'm coming home from delivering food to one of the families, I get a text message telling me to check Facebook. I check Facebook and I see it's a confession from that young man who had messaged me in March, essentially saying that he was sent by the NYPD to investigate terrorism and that he didn't find anything, but he's finally coming out to confess that this is what he was there to do.
What was the outcome of that lawsuit?
The outcome of that lawsuit was a historic settlement that we reached in 2016, and that finally became policy in 2017. We secured a number of policy changes. So among them being the fact that the NYPD can no longer initiate an investigation where race, religion, or ethnicity are substantial or motivating factors. A second gain being that if they initiate an investigation and do not find anything after 6 months, they must terminate it. So they cannot continue indefinitely. Another one was the appointment of a civilian representative, basically someone to monitor the NYPD who is unaffiliated with the police and who happens to be an attorney and who is held accountable by us, the community. So these are three of many. One more I'll briefly mention is the termination of the radicalization report, which was published in 2007, which essentially criminalized mundane religious observances by Muslims, like growing a beard or wearing a hijab or going to the mosque. And so that report was terminated as a consequence of our lawsuit.
I should mention here, we reached out to the NYPD for comment for the show, but didn't hear back in time. That offer still stands. Asad, how did this experience affect the type of organizing you do?
It profoundly changed not just my organizing, but my entire life. You know, friends drifted away. You know, some people in my local community distanced themselves out of fear in the immediate aftermath of the confession. There was a great sort of feeling of mistrust pervading in the community, not knowing who is, you know, if the person praying next to you is a government agent. At the same time, it was very empowering. So I do want to include that and say that to see the support from people like Rosina, right, journalists, scholars like Deepa, and activists on the ground, I think gave many of us a deep sense of hope and you know, the idea that we can endure. And thankfully we did. You know, we pushed, and you know, this groundbreaking settlement changed a lot of things for us. And I like to think I became a much better organizer because of it.
Deepa, we get a sense of it from Asad's story, but help us understand some of the surveillance techniques used in New York and across the country after 9/11.
Yeah, so essentially the logic behind these surveillance programs was that if you are Muslim, you are predisposed to commit crimes, right? You are ideologically driven to commit violent acts. And so it's not just the NYPD, but it's police departments across the country, the FBI and so on, who acted on this very racist assumption that somehow all Muslims are predisposed, are potential terrorists, and therefore it was necessary to collect information from them. Asad, your story is so important for people to hear about your own experience of seeing that there were agents in your very community. And that's what we've seen. The FBI actually had a national program and continues to have this program where it sends agent provocateurs into communities to not just collect information, but also to entrap vulnerable people. The journalist Trevor Aronson actually has done the most sort of detailed research on this, where agents will go in, talk to people, talk them into carrying out an attack, provide them with the so-called ammunition, you know, they're not, it's not really bombs and so on, and then, you know, incite them to carry this out, and then they get arrested. This happened with the Newburgh 4 case, where these four African-American men were entrapped by such an informant into carrying out an attack on a synagogue in the Bronx. And one of them expressed great hesitancy to do it, saying, I don't want to kill, you know, innocent people, especially children and women. But the informant chastised him and sort of insisted that they go through with it. And then when they are going in their van to the Bronx, the police show up, and unsurprisingly, the media are all there, and the mayor, you know, takes all credit for it and says, yet another terror plot has been, you know, foiled. So this has been going on all over the U.S. because of this assumption that somehow all Muslims are potential terrorists and therefore must be entrapped before they actually do anything.
Rosina, what did this type of surveillance mean for families and communities?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing it really did was create an atmosphere of fear. And there were so many people I have spoken to and interviewed told me that they were afraid of going to the mosque, of speaking politically. Even now, people are afraid of voicing their political opinions. And I think it's, you know, it's hard to overstate just how pervasive the surveillance was. Deepa was mentioning the use of informants. The FBI's stable of informants grew to 15,000. And these weren't just FBI agents. These were civilians who had incentive to supposedly find terrorists for the government. And they used money, they used personal connections, they created relationships with their targets. As a result, men ended up in prison for decades without ever having committed an actual crime of violence. And I think that's astonishing. I wrote a piece in April about one man who had low IQ, who was targeted by an NYPD informant for a year and a half, almost 2 years. He ended up in prison for 30 years because of something he said. He never actually committed an act of violence. And when I speak to him now, he's just afraid to voice any political opinion, as is his family. And that's stifling, and that's chilling for a country that prides itself in its First Amendment rights.
We're reflecting on the experience of Muslims in America after 9/11. We'll hear more from you and our guests in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BASF. North American Chairman and CEO Michael Hines shares why they're taking on the challenge of improving the batteries in electric cars.
We are one of the major suppliers of the main ingredients that you would find in a car manufacturer's battery. And as the automotive industry is shifting more towards electromobility, we also have a responsibility through science to come up with some of these solutions.
To learn more about BASF's battery material innovations, go to BASF.com.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Now let's get back to our conversation on post-9/11 Islamophobia. Here's an email we got from Gordon, who asks, what is it that motivates a person to buy into or go through with the entrapment efforts of the police or the FBI? Is it money? Assad, were you able to deduce the motivations of the person who was informing on your group?
I'm grateful that you're asking me this question, because the particular informant who had messaged me was actually, by his own admission, of a troubled background. He had gotten kicked out of college. He got into fights. He had drug addiction issues. He was struggling with mental illness. And one day he was caught, I believe it was, on drug possession charges. And essentially the police confronted him. They said, either you can face up to 15 years or you do surveillance work for us. They had initially asked him to spy on a narcotics gang, and he refused. And then they eventually told him that he can spy on Muslims instead. And they offered him, I think it was something around $1,500 a month. I do want to emphasize that this is the type of individual who needed help. This was the type of person who needed counseling. They needed mental health services. They needed, drug rehab, so on and so forth. If he had gotten the help that he needed, he wouldn't have had to take on, this job that he did. And of course, this is not to justify it, but more to say that this is speaks to a societal failure and speaks to how we, have almost a callous disregard for the most vulnerable in our society. And, there are different motivations, for different people. Some do it for the money, some do it because they truly believe they're doing what they're doing. But I can say that this particular individual did it because he was forced into a very difficult position that no one should have to be forced into.
I want to turn to this audio now. This is President George W. Bush. He famously visited an Islamic center in D.C. to dissuade anti-Muslim sentiment following 9/11.
These acts of violence against innocents violate the fundamental tenets of the Islamic faith. And it's important for my fellow Americans to understand that. The English translation is not as eloquent as the original Arabic, but let me quote from the Quran itself. In the long run, evil in the extreme will be the end of those who do evil. The face of terror is not the true faith of Islam. That's not what Islam is all about. Islam is peace. These terrorists don't represent peace. They represent evil and war.
Assad, 10 years after President Bush's speech, you were still being targeted by the NYPD. What does it say to you that there was so much distance between some, not all, but some of the political rhetoric of the time and the actual policies that went into effect?
I think a lot of the rhetoric, in this little excerpt you played by President Bush, in many ways, serves almost as a cover-up for the policies, right? You can have politicians who say nice things, right? Set aside the academic debate on whether, Islam is a religion of peace or violence. That's irrelevant. But politicians can make these comments and almost as a way excuse themselves and use them as an excuse to sort of recuse themselves, right? Bush launched two wars that devastated the lives of millions of people, almost entirely Muslim. To say that, this is to distance Muslims from this while also targeting them, I think it's a way of making excuses for oneself. And I think policies speak louder than words.
Here's a question we got from S.O., who says, ask about African-American Muslims and intersectional bias against them from all fronts. Deepa, what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I do the long history of anti-Muslim racism in the U.S. from the foundation of the U.S. nation, actually even before that, the colonial period, up to the present. And I think the experience of Black Muslims is a very important part of the story, and I really thank the listener for raising it. I think the first thing to be said is that the first significant presence of Muslims in the United States were West African Muslims who were enslaved and brought here to work on plantations. But interestingly, because they were highly educated, the scholarship shows that they were not treated as badly as non-Muslim enslaved people. The targeting of Black Muslims really begins in earnest in the 20th century. This is when, in the 1930s, J. Edgar Hoover would go after the Moorish Science Temple of America. This was a group of people who had a form of practice of Islam that was transnational, that was anti-white supremacy, that was internationalist and anti-imperialist. And for the FBI, that was just too much of a threat. So they start a program of intensive surveillance in the 1930s. They even bring lawsuits against people of the Moorish Science Temple as a way to give an example. Don't you dare oppose white supremacy. This is what will happen. And these programs actually continue and will be used against the Nation of Islam, against Malcolm X, and they continue even today. So that has absolutely been a parallel story. And so when we talk about, you know, the state targeting Muslims, we shouldn't just focus on Arabs and Iranians and South Asians, but we have to bring in this conversation about what Black Muslims have faced.
I want to talk a bit about what we're seeing now. Rosina, Muslim Americans have become visible in certain ways that they weren't before. Lawmakers like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib being the first Muslim women to serve in Congress, Mahershala Ali being the first Muslim person to win an Oscar. How much does that visibility matter?
I think it matters a lot. I think there is definitely, especially for the long term, to normalize Muslims in these industries and leadership roles is critical. I do think that, you know, there have been a lot of groups and lawsuits like Asad's that have challenged the government's policies. But I do want to emphasize that while it's great that we have Muslims in office and media and cultural institutions, we might even have the second Muslim federal judge soon. Much of the infrastructure that was put in place after 9/11 and sometimes even before 9/11, that still continues. There is still very little transparency about how the FBI uses informants and when. There is still a use of broad material support charges to arrest and put away people, even if they haven't committed an actual crime. And, you know, when the Supreme Court upheld Trump's travel ban, it justified the decision by citing policies that the Obama and Bush administration had put forward and basically saying that national security is the purview of the president. All of these things have yet to be challenged. And, you know, I hope in the next 10 years that we really see a scaling back of the war on terror framework that we put in place after 9/11.
We just have about a minute left here, but I'd love to hear from each of you what you see on the path ahead. We're doing a lot of reflecting on the last 20 years, but to your mind, what's next? Asad?
I'm hopeful. I'm seeing a lot of reflection, and I'm seeing a lot of, reckoning. Sadly, that reckoning is not coming from the institutions of power, and I'm not going to depend on institutions of power, to take us forward in a positive and constructive direction. But I am hopeful that everyday people can bear witness to everything that we've endured, as Muslims, as South Asians, as Arabs, as Americans, as people who are impacted, and that they can learn from it. So I want to end, my message on a hopeful note, and to say that, hope is a discipline. It's something that you consciously cultivate, and it's something that you work towards. And I'm grateful to be in community with so many people who are doing precisely that.
Deepa, what about for you?
Yeah, so one of the moments that really cut against the stereotypes and the racism against Muslims was the Arab Spring, what's called the Arab Spring, in which people saw, young people in Tunisia, in Egypt, standing up against dictators, US-backed dictators, toppling them. And there was an immense sort of moment of recognizing that we're all in the same boat. So in Wisconsin, in the Madison protests, for instance, people carried signs that said, fight like an Egyptian, right? And there was a profound understanding that we're all human beings together within a system that actually is, you know, is bad for all of us. I want to say a little bit about
We actually have to wrap here, unfortunately. We could spend another hour together. That's Professor Deepa Kumar. She's a professor of media studies at Rutgers University and the author of Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire, 20 Years After 9/11. Asad Dandia, a New York-based educator and organizer, and Rosina Ali. She's a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. Thanks to you all. Today's producer was Arfi Getty. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.